So, perfect. 10 seconds past noon. And, well, welcome back to the lecture. As for the games engineering students, the concerning the lab course, assignment two, the deadline has been prolonged, well, I guess for 2 weeks, okay? So for all of those that are still struggling with their games implementations, you'd have 2 more weeks, okay? Which implies that we also have to shift the deadlines for the assignments 3 and 4, but we would only do so with respect to or in terms of 1 week only, right? Because I don't want to get into trouble with respect to the end of the semester. My goal is for the games engineering students that they are able to do the lab course just within the precise boundaries of the lecture time, okay? And tomorrow we'll be introducing the task or assignment number 3, dealing with network analysis methods for gold farmers detection and another subtopic dealing with viral marketing, okay? And so the social computing students that are interested are also cordially welcome, but it's mainly targeted for the games engineering students, okay? So tomorrow, at this very strange time of 8 o'clock, Niklas and I will be here. And if you want to utter other questions with respect to the lab course, you're also invited to do so, okay? Once again, concerning questions for all of you, if you have any questions regarding these things, yeah, whatever it is, please don't hesitate to come down and ask me after the lecture. So on Tuesdays I have time, on Wednesdays as well. So if you also happen to have time, I'm willing to explain anything to you. And the second thing that I'm still willing to offer, I know that the games engineering students are not required to also take the course on probability theory, right? And upcoming in this lecture, presumably there is some probability theory, right? And if some of you want me to give an extra course on probability theories, just the basics like Bayes theorem, probability distributions, how do we do probabilistic reasoning and so on, you're cordially invited to tell me via your Semestersprecher or Semestersprecherin in that case, and we can arrange for that, yeah? Like, not too long, but if that should be the case, I'm willing to give it. Second remark, if any of you have problems with math concerning these things, like don't know what is a trace, what is an eigenvalue, we can also deal with that. At least I can point you to some introductory texts which are manageable in thickness in terms of number of pages so that you can maybe try to repeat what you probably would not have on your radar, okay? So just come down, involve me in discussions, and we'll see what we can do. So that's for the organizational aspects, and let's get back to the actual topics. So where were we in the lecture? So we started, as you all have noticed, with social network analysis topics, and then we arrived at the problem of finding groups or communities, yeah? And I think you don't need much fantasy to imagine that these things are really useful, not only for social media, social networking, but also for games, especially those new forms of games that try to blend your all-day life with your games life, okay? So if these things start to blend, if you start to have like guilds and other groups that work together offline, online, in a mobile social setting or the like, it's clear that it's good to know what's happening in your network of gamers in terms of groups, right? And we looked at several algorithms that were able to kind of determine groups in these networks. And the paradigm was always intra-cluster coherence and intercluster decoherence. And that we said we could formalize in these quality measures, F plus G, and we had several examples of these. And then the only task you're left with is to do optimization. Yeah. And speaking of optimization, we looked at greedy methods. And speaking of greedy methods, we also dug a little bit deeper into agglomerative techniques, especially single link and complete link techniques. Okay. And they made use of such a local cost function, which is, in a sense, yeah, the other way to look at these clustering paradigms, okay? So you can formalize the clustering paradigm in an overall global measure, and that can be a measure of quality, which you try to maximize, or alternatively, it could be a measure of cost, which you would then try to minimize. Okay, but in essence, it's the same thing, same task you're facing, just model something. And that's something you would find throughout computer science. You have, let's say, some aspect of reality, and you would try to mold this into a function of some sort, which you would then feed into an optimization process. It's about the same thing in machine learning, right? So typical probabilistic machine learning that's modern that people use would start from a probabilistic model of some sort, yeah? And that model is nothing but a formalization of your intuition. And then you are faced with optimization techniques. Yeah? Even the most advanced machine learning basically works like that, okay? Okay, that's where we ended up with, and the last task in this part of the lecture was this Gervin-Newman method, okay? Mark Newman is someone that has crossed our paths for a few times now. We had this paper about this electrical network-based centralities, and Mark Newman also wrote this large, thick book called Networks that it kind of encompasses most of the stuff that's known about these things. And but we will later on in the lecture focus on a smaller survey by Mark Newman that he did about complex networks, which is a bit more compact, right? But he's a physicist, and lots of physicists these days are doing these social computing things. Yeah, so you find them throughout all the conferences. Now, he, together with Gervin, devised a method for finding groups, and he actually doesn't call them groups, he calls them communities. And that's maybe a more appropriate term for us, since we already discussed that if we're really after groups in the small group sense of sociology, we're better off with these prototypical techniques like cliques and n-plexes and so on. If you do clustering, naturally you can kind of guide via some parameters how large the clusters would be. But in essence, what you're interested in is finding a dendrogram-like clustering structure for the whole network. Okay, so we remember here a dendrogram was a tree which kind of formalized the overall clustering structure. By overall, I mean ranging from very fine clusters towards the leaves to very coarse clusters towards the root. Yeah? And the question was always, where do we cut the dendrogram? Where do we make a point? Yeah? And that we will get to in a second. Okay. And so the larger groupings here, so cutting it in the upper regions of the tree, would would correspond to finding communities. Okay, so that's more like larger groups of people, naturally. Okay, now how does this method work? So the idea, as I said last week, is to continuously keep on removing edges. And what kind of edges? Okay, so first of all, we need to know that this is a divisive algorithm. So you start with the social network in question, and you try to separate it into smaller subsets until you arrive at the singleton clusters. Yeah, so continuously splitting what you have, but in a meaningful way. And how do we do that? So what we find in social networks, and this is something we're going to look at in more detail later, is that social networks have a distinctively high clustering coefficient. So the typical structure is that people organize themselves in local groupings, yeah, and these local groupings are then connected via edges, okay? So for example, assume that you're living in the countryside of Bavaria or Scotland or wherever, yeah, and there's a cluster of small villages. And these villages, the villagers obviously know themselves in a clique-like fashion. So if you live in a small village, you know everybody. And there's a strong exchange of information such that the saturation of information exchange is very quickly reached. Okay, so in such a village, there is not much secrecy in terms of at least public information. So everybody knows what everybody else knows. And then there are these few hip, super cool people that know somebody in Munich or London or wherever. And what they comprise is, long range edges that kind of connect these small groupings. And that's a typical architecture of social networks, and you would find these groupings on various levels. And so what we find is that the groups are typically well connected among themselves, but only connected in between them with very few edges. Yeah, and if you want to make a divisive algorithm that finds correct clusters, what you should do is you should remove those intercluster edges. Okay, if you do so, continuously do so, then the network will fall apart into components, yeah, which are not connected anymore, but connected within them. And you would then continuously go on splitting those components until you arrive at the singleton clusters. And an intelligent idea is to start or to remove those edges that have a high centrality, right? Because they're supposed to be important in a sense. But the question is, which centrality measure are we going to take? And in the original algorithm, Newman and Girvan proposed shortest path betweenness. Why? Okay, it's only natural because shortest path betweenness, we said, kind of captures the flow of information. Yeah, if some edge happens to be on very many smallest, shortest paths, then this edge is kind of important, and it has a high probability of being such a inter-community edge. And you keep on removing these until the graph or the network falls apart into components. Yeah? And that gives rise to the upper levels of the dendrogram, and then you start splitting those again. Yeah. However, there is one pitfall in that, and that is assume, for example, the following situation. So you would have two parts of the graph. Yeah. So the graph is somewhere outside still, and they're very well connected among themselves. And let's assume there are two edges that kind of connect these. Yeah. One very thick edge, thick in the sense of having a high weight, and the other one such a feeble, low-weight edge, okay? Now, let's assume you start doing your magic with shortest path betweenness, and the first edge that you're going to throw out is probably this one, okay? But still, these two components keep on being connected, yeah? And so that edge would probably, let's assume it does not occur in too many shortest paths, okay? Let's assume there is still other edges that kind of are more central in that regard. Okay, so that one would probably be removed way later on through throughout the algorithm. And the goal and the idea is to recompute shortest path betweenness after each removal. Okay, because then if this edge is not present anymore, we would still have that, and since the betweenness values would then be computed anew, this one would surely be on very many shortest path and would be the next candidate to be thrown away, such that you have disconnected components left. So the idea, as it's written on the slide, is to keep on recomputing the shortest path betweenness all the time. Okay. Now, Ulrich Brandes came up with an algorithm that runs in O of M times N, if I'm not completely mistaken, for finding these shortest path betweenness values. And if you do that for all the edges in the graph, continuously removing them, the worst case time complexity is M square N. And while this is not nice in the original sense, at least for sparse graphs, you might be able to solve that if n, or respectively m, is not too large. Okay, so that's the idea. And it turned out that this method actually works very well, and you're free to use other centrality measures that kind of capture your intuition of your problem in a better way. Yeah. So if you say, wasn't there a critique on shortest path betweenness? Wasn't it the case that random walks or electrical current based centralities work better? Yes, the answer is yes, but it depends on what you want to model. Okay. Good. Now, but still, as you can imagine, we could find some dendrogram. Yeah. The question is, where do we actually make the cut? What is the optimal cluster structure for that network? And what you always do is to come up with a cluster validity or quality measure. Yeah, that's just a formalization of your intuition, what actually intra-cluster sparseness and inter-cluster coherence, intra-cluster coherence means. And in that case, it's modularity. Yeah, and that's just that function. And we would cut the dendrogram where this function has a maximum. Yeah, that's a typical way to go about in clustering. And one extra remark, all the clustering approaches, or most of the clustering approaches, I should say, have the problem that you would need to know the number of clusters that you want in advance. Yeah. For example, k-means clustering that we're going to encounter today is a typical example where you would have to know k in advance. Yeah. But these cluster validity measures are a way to deal with that, because you can compute all the clusterings for each k and then decide what's the one that is optimal in a certain sense. Yeah. And that's more or less what we find here. Okay. And the idea which we ended up last time was that this modularity kind of compares the actual connectivity with the connectivity in a random graph that has the same principal connectivity structure. Okay, and that worked in the following way. Okay, just to repeat that from last time. Now, let's assume that's our graph, okay? And let's assume the current decomposition into clusters is given by these red lines here, okay? What we can then do, we can count the intercluster edges or the relative number of intercluster edges by that term, okay? So we get a matrix, which is a K times K symmetric matrix. In that case, small k is 3, okay? And that's just the connectivity between clusters, okay? That's what we use all the time, yeah? So if we happen to have weights on the edges, the idea is to just use multigraphs, yeah? That's in essence the same stuff. So let's assume this is our graph, which let's say looks like this. Yeah, very simple graph. And if you have weights like 3, 2, 1, what you can do is just draw 3 edges here, yeah, and draw 2 edges here, and draw a single edge here. Yeah. So in that way you can formalize the weights And you would see that the bookkeeping just stays the same. Yeah. Just have to count the number of edges. Okay. So that's our matrix. And our measure for F would be just the trace of that matrix. And that would be the fraction of edges that are within the communities. Yeah. Intra-cluster coherence. Okay. And if we sum over the columns for a special row, what we get is the, degree of such a cluster, right? So the degree of that cluster here would be 1, 2, 3, yeah, because it has three edges connecting it to others, okay? Good. And so that's that. And what we want is we want to compare actually this trace to a expression that would result from a random network that just keeps the degrees fixed. Okay? So what you do is you would take these pseudo nodes, yeah, these new large nodes, and you would record their number of edges that go out, like in this case 3, yeah, 1, 2, 3. But you would then deal out the intercluster edges randomly, yeah, as well as the intracluster edges as well. Okay, so these would then be the ones that go from a cluster back to a cluster. Okay, so what you do, and I had this on the board last time. So for these three, you would say, okay, we'd have three connections to the outside, yeah. And this one has also three connections. This one has some. And then you would deal out the edges randomly. And what you find is that the probability that cluster I and J are connected is just proportional to the degree of I times the degree of J. Yeah? If both are high, then the probability of really dealing the random edge between those two is high. Okay? And if we want to compare our original trace, our intracluster coherence, with the intracluster coherence resulting from the random graph, all we need to do is to subtract the trace from the trace of this random graph's connectivity matrix. Okay? And then if this difference should be high, yeah, what is the interpretation? So if that's large and that's small, yeah, then we would know that this is a good clustering, yeah, because it kind of has a high intracluster coherence, whereas the respective intracluster coherence of the random graph is then small, yeah. And the better the clustering, the higher is that absolute difference. Yeah? So Q in itself is the quality measure that we use. Yeah? And what I would advertise is if you think, well, yeah, at least it's plausible, but I don't get the true details here. Take 5 minutes of your time. Try to think of the random process that kind of generates the random graph, try to understand that. And if you have difficulties, I linked the Newman paper, which again is very well written. You don't need to read all of that. Just read the section about this construction. And I think you'll probably be able to grasp what's going on there. Okay, so that was the Newman-Irvin method. And in our original reading, yeah, so the chapter by Gertler, they have a different notion of modularity, and that one would just deal out the edges completely at random, not respecting the AIs, not keeping these connectivities fixed, these degrees. And then naturally, dealing out an edge has the probability of just the numbers of nodes that are in there, yeah, over the total number of pairs that are possible, right? So that's a straightforward expression of really randomly dealing out M edges of whatever provenance, okay? Good. So that's that. And, basically that's the one, that's another formulation, but, yeah, look at this if you've read the paper, okay? There's also a variant in the adapter, but this is more or less the same. Okay, good. So that was that in terms of graph clustering. Okay. Still, it's a clustering technique that works on discrete structures, on graphs. Yeah. But the question is, okay, in the beginning of that slide set, I told you something about groups. Okay. And, or beginning of the other slide set even. Yeah. And what we said is there is something like pseudo groups as well. Yeah. So if I would just say all the people whose height is between 1.70 meters and 1.72 meters. Yeah. That's certainly a group in the sense of data mining, but it just doesn't make sense. Yeah. But what that tells us is that besides clustering approaches that work on networks, what we can still do is classical data mining, because people would have profiles, okay? Sorry. And in these profiles, certainly they reveal things about themselves, and these things can be used to infer groupings. Yeah. One example that is, yeah, maybe not along the same lines as I just said, but along the same lines of something else, is the problem of the following sort. So I maybe told you about studies we do on mobility patterns. Okay. So the rough question is, are the mobility patterns of friends more likely to look the same as the mobility patterns of two randomly selected persons? Yeah. Which then has implications on recommender algorithms, for example. Yeah. So if you have ever encountered the problem of, let's say it's Saturday night. Yeah. You've been to a club. Two of your friends you were with just said, I'm tired. I'm going home. It's 1 o'clock and you say, well, I still want to go out somewhere, but I just don't know where all the people are that I like. Yeah. And normally you're left with guessing. Okay. And then you go to a club, and then in most cases, it's not very nice because you're on your own. If you were to go to a club where all your friends actually are, yeah. I mean, then maybe you could have a better evening, things like that. And if you want to do that, you would naturally have to kind of, observe the mobility patterns of people. Once again, it's an issue of privacy. It's an issue of ethics. Yeah. So don't confuse that. But if you have your own GPS traces, yeah, then let's say every 5 seconds, your GPS device kind of measures your location. Okay. But the question is, what are actually places? And what's intermediary transitory movements, okay? And a simple idea is to do clustering, right? So if people keep on, let's say the campus in Garching is such a location in that sense. And while you're here, let's say from 10 to 4 in the evening, you keep on moving around here, yeah? Like this, and your traces keep on accumulating. So it's only natural to say, if I do some sort of clustering with intelligent social heuristics, then I'm able to identify what's actually a place, yeah, and not just a set of points, yeah. And that's another application that we actually used that for, but there were others where we would use, for example, the Newman-Gerwin method, yeah, in other studies. Okay, good. So that's that. Now, speaking of data mining and speaking of clustering that works on profile elements, question is, how do we do that? Yeah. And this is about the next lecture, which I just closed. No, I didn't. And that's about metric clustering. Okay. Okay. And this is certainly something that you may find useful for other fields as well, yeah? And maybe some of you have come across clustering algorithms that we would introduce here, but maybe not come across all of them. Okay. So would you give me an indication who has been in the machine learning lecture by Patrick van der Smaak? Who has been to my machine learning tutorial? Okay. At least one person. Okay, good. That's okay. Good. So we'll try to deal with that anyway. Yeah. Good. So that's basically what we had. We had this more elaborate model of a social network having edge profiles and node profiles. And the question is, can we do clustering on these edge or node profiles? Okay. So typically, such a profile would contain personal data, biographic data, which we could use for personalization, but it would also contain contextual data, location, velocity, people around, current emotional state, stuff like that. And the edge profiles would maybe contain information on the relation that you have with that person, or a record of when this relation has been instantiated. When have you met this person? Yeah. And these are all the things that you may have. And speaking of the general type of relation, an easy thing to put in edge profiles is the topic spectrum that you would discuss with that person. Okay. And that's just, let's say fixed to your relation only. Yeah. Limited to that only. Good. So these are the things that are in profiles, and we know they are on various scales of measurement. That's something I already talked about. So we have the typical scales of measurement that we find for profile elements. Yeah, nominal scales, ordinally scaled profile elements, interval scaled profile elements, and proportionally scaled or ratio scaled elements. Okay. And however, many of these profile elements are in some metric space, yeah? Or at least you can construct something like a metric space. Yeah? And as an example, let's look at two things. First of all, the first example is location and velocity, and that's something I already had on the blackboard here, but these were only locations, not velocities. Yeah. And if you want to decide upon co-locations, for example, yeah, then naturally what you can do is you can have that pattern for person one and another pattern for person two. Yeah, and then you can compare them. But velocity is also interesting, at least potentially, because if people are close, then maybe they're co-located. But if the arrows of velocity point like that, you would know that it was just some transitory coincidence. Yeah. So you can also work with velocities. And another completely different cup of tea is text, for example. Yeah. Because lots of profile elements and lots of social media content is necessarily text. And text is something that is at first glance not very accessible. Yeah, as something in the metric space, but you can easily turn it into something in a metric space. And one very simple technique is the vector space model that has been introduced by Salton in the late 1980s or so as a technique for information retrieval. And that's the way it works, okay? So you have a text. I like to dance samba, bake pizza, watch TV, and plant trees in the garden, also cakes. Whatever also cakes means, okay? So maybe that's a statement on your interests, yeah? And the question is, how do you turn that into something in a metric space? And the answer is you can simply count tokens. You can count words, okay? And if you do so, you would find that, let's say the word I would occur two times in that text, yeah? So the text is supposed to be something like that, yeah? And I, we can count, occurs two times, like also occurs two times, and so on and so on. So that's called a term frequency, yeah? And the simple heuristic behind it is that terms that occur more frequently than others are also more important for conveying the sense or the meaning or the semantics of the text. Yeah. As you can see, this is only partly true because things like personal pronouns and words like with or that or so certainly are the ones that occur most frequently. So what you do is you remove them from your consideration, and that's called stop word removal. Yeah. Stop word removal is not totally easy, because you may have words like can, yeah, which is certainly a stop word in most texts because it's a simple verb, yeah, which appears all the time. But in a text on waste management, this is clearly a key term. Yeah. So stop word removal, not easy, but we can do that. Now, but that's still not the whole story, because there is something else which besides of term frequency, and that's called the inverse document frequency, IDF. Yeah. And that just accounts for the fact that a word that occurs in all the texts that you have is not very valuable when you want to discriminate between them. Okay? So let's say you have texts on computer science and you want to do a clustering later on, or you want to do information retrieval. The word computer itself is not very meaningful because it will appear in all the texts. Yeah? But in contrast to that, the word graph, for example, or the word probability, or let's say the word compiler, better example, is much more specific because it will appear only in documents about compiler construction. So what we do is just we take the logarithm of the number of documents where this term occurs over the total number of documents in your collection. Yeah, and that's just a measure how often that appears across these texts. Okay, and what comes out is a highly dimensional vector, a real valued vector. So assuming that the vocabulary of modern English is something like 50,000 words, what you typically deal with is 50,000 dimensional vectors. Yeah. And then these you can multiply and so on and so on. And the usual technique that you would use for information retrieval in the simplest form is something that is called the cosine measure. And let's assume you want to compare a query, yeah, and the query contains of 10 words, okay, and you want to compare this query to all your documents in your collection and find those documents that are likely to be similar to the query. So what you do is the query is also just in that 50,000 dimensional space. It's just a vector, but it only has 10 entries which are non-zero and 49,990 entries which are zero. Yeah, but still it's a vector. And the documents in your collection are also vectors with probably less zeros than the query. And what you can just do is you can compute the angle that is between those two vectors with the help of the cosine, which is nothing but, if this is Q, and this is D, yeah, query document, it's just the scalar product, if I write this with these arrows, of these two, yeah, or at least proportional to if you leave out the norms of these two vectors, yeah. So that's a very simple technique that very early search engines used, and it's still in use in many papers these days, yeah. There are much more intelligent ways to do that, by the way, but at least that is simple. Yeah. So you can reduce that to linear algebra. So the lesson learned is that whatever you have in profiles can, in essence, be made numeric. Yeah. And then if it's made numeric, we can apply the techniques that we're going to discuss now. Okay. Still, yeah, we have all the same notation as before, So a clustering, and it's in graph clustering we had that a clustering is a set, is a partition of the set of nodes into non-empty subsets. And now a clustering would be a mapping of our value space to a set of indices, yeah, which is more or less the same. Let's assume our value or feature space is the R2, yeah. So each profile element is some vector in that R2, yeah. What we want is we want a separation into distinct regions where we say all these that are in here are mapped to class label 2, and these are mapped into class label 1, and all the rest is mapped to class label 3, if you have 3 classes, okay? And still, we can have exclusive clusterings where a point is only a member of a single cluster, or we can have non-exclusive, where these things overlap, or they may overlap. We can have crisp clusterings, where this mapping is, strictly deterministic in a sense. Or we can have something that's called fuzzy clustering. And in fuzzy clustering, you have the following. So, how do I do that? Let's do that with that one. Good. Let's have some more space on that whiteboard. So, good. Ooh, what a mess. Okay. So as I said on the slides, a crisp clustering really determinately maps the space, the feature space X to the index space of the clusters. Okay. Now, in essence, this mapping C, well, it's an ugly C like this. Well, okay. What this mapping does, so C of some X in that R2 is some I, and this one is in that large space X, and this one is in that index space, yeah? So this is a discrete mapping. Either X is mapped to 2 or to 15 or to 20. And what a fuzzy clustering would do, it would map, so C fuzzy, yeah? So that's C crisp. C fuzzy would take the X and map it if I is, let's say, the if I is, let's say, 10. Yeah? So we have 10 clusters. Okay. What this maps this to is membership degrees, M1, M2, until M10, where all these cluster memberships would sum to 1. Yeah. And the interpretation is that a pattern X belongs to cluster 2 to a degree M2. Let's say 0.1, yeah? 10%. And let's say M1 is 0.8. What the statement is that this pattern belongs to cluster 1 much more than to cluster 2. That's, in essence, what fuzzy clustering is. And last but not least, we can also have these hierarchical approaches, like in the dendrograms. Okay? Good. And that's just what's here. Yeah? So crisp clusterings, crisp clusterings would have a membership or characteristic function that maps to either 0 or 1, or shouldn't say that. Yeah. Okay, good. In crisp clusterings, we have either to 0 or 1, if it's a member of the respective cluster or not. So it's another way to formalize it. And in fuzzy clustering, the membership function maps to the whole interval of 0 and 1. Okay? An example. Okay? So you remember single link and complete link clustering. Yeah? So single link was very optimistic, taking the minimum of the distance between clusters for distance between nodes to decide upon the costs for local merging, and CompleteLink was rather pessimistic, yeah, wanting to have complete clusters. Okay. Now, here we have a complete analog in our case. So the single link distance measure would also be the minimum, but now we wouldn't have path lengths or something. What we have is just the metric distance, okay, because we are assumed to be in a metric space. But function-wise, in its modeling aspects, these things are really completely analogous to what we had for the graph clustering case. Yeah? And you would proceed in the same way. Start with singletons and then work your way up to the one clustering. But now using these metric spaces. Yeah? Good. It was more like theoretical blah, blah. Can't you give us a complete, a nice, real, concrete algorithm? Answer, yes, I can. Okay? I'm not Barack Obama, but I can. And that's for example, K-means clustering. That's very popular. Who has heard of K-means before? Hands up. Who has never heard of K-means before? Hands up. Good, so that's the majority. Good. So the general idea of clustering in that metric spaces is still, as we had, optimize a objective function, okay? And this is also the case for K-means, and in a sense, yeah, we will see what the actual objective function is. What K-means does is only work on that F part, so we want to optimize the intra-cluster coherence. And the technique, don't know if I have slides, yeah, like that, so we'll see that in a second, yeah? So we'll describe every cluster by a prototype, yeah? And a prototype is some fictional pattern in that metric space that kind of is typical for that cluster. And let's assume our metric space is the R2, and we'd have these actual patterns. What we say is that we can have one prototype that represents this cluster and one prototype that somehow represents this cluster. Yeah, it's just a point in the feature space. Yeah, and the rule by which we determine what cluster a new pattern would belong to is it belongs to that cluster with the minimal distance. So in that case, if that's cluster 1 and that's cluster 2, this new pattern would belong to cluster 1 because that distance is smaller than that distance. Yeah, that's just the way we determine which cluster a pattern would belong to. Okay. And what K-means does is it optimizes just that function. Yeah, so that's nothing but a cluster validity measure, but now in a metric space. Don't have any path lengths anymore in any discrete cases. What we have is a metric that we use. Okay, and assuming that we know the cluster centers mu k, so a measure that formalizes the intra-cluster coherence is just the average distance of the patterns in that cluster CK to their prototypes. Yeah. So a cluster that looks like this, yeah, is much tighter, and the distance to its prototype is on average much smaller than if you had such a cluster which has also a prototype, but the average distance is much larger. Yeah. So that's why this is the right objective function. And optimizing that is simple. Yeah. So you can compute the derivation with respect to mu k, set it to 0. And what you get, if you do that, the mu k, and sorry for the superscript, should be a subscript. These mu k are just the, yeah, these averages of these patterns, or the Barry centers, yeah, centers of gravity, if you want. So you sum up all these pattern vectors and set them into proportion to the extension of the cluster, and then what you have is the mu k. Yeah? And if it's an n-dimensional pattern space, the xn are n-dimensional vectors or m-dimensional vectors, and the mu k's are also n-dimensional vectors. Okay? So that's rather simple. But how does the actual algorithm proceed? Yeah, so here it is. I wrote down the algorithm, but we're going to do it here using the example. So what the algorithm does is a typical alternating optimization procedure. Yeah? And what you start with is this green set of points, yeah, in the upper left corner. Okay. And what we can see with our eyes, which are excellent clustering devices, is that we have two clusters here, or at least two clusters is the intuitive number of clusters. Let's assume somebody told you so, and you wanted to start the algorithm with two clusters. What you do is you start with random locations for these barycenters, which are this one and this one. And then, if you determine these positions for the mu1 and mu2, then you start to compute the cluster assignments. Yeah? Mm-hmm. And the cluster assignments are computed with the help of that rule. Yeah? So each pattern is associated with that cluster that has just the nearest prototype. So for our red and blue clusters, exactly those that are to the right of that skew line here are assigned to the red cluster. Those that are to the left are assigned to the blue cluster. Okay? So that's our new situation. And then you start to compute your new cluster centers with that barycenter formula here. Yeah? In essence, that means that you take all the red points here, sum them together and divide them by their number. And then you get this new center for the red cluster. If you do the same for the blue, you get this new center. And then you start to come up with a new assignment, yeah, which is this one, using the nearest neighbor rule. And then you have your new assignment. These are now the red ones, and these are now the blue ones. And then you go on with this alternating process until it converges. Yeah. So compute the new cluster assignments, compute the new locations for the cluster centers, new assignments, new centers, new assignments, new centers, new assignments, new centers, and so on. And what you see in that example here is that these algorithms usually converge very quickly, yeah? So you don't need very many iterations until you arrive at the solution. And what we see is that it appears to be a good clustering algorithm so far, and k-means is widely used, yeah? The disadvantages are that you would have a tendency to favor spherical clusters, and you would have to know k in advance. Yeah. So if you have a cluster structure that looks like this, or let's say even harder, yeah, something like this, and these are your clusters 1, 2, 3. While we can still separate them with our visual system, k-means would have difficulties because these are highly non-spherical. Yeah? And this way of computing new cluster centers, as well as this nearest neighbor rule, give you the intuition that spherical clusters are favored by this. Okay? Good.
Where would you get clusters like that you would also use k-means cluster?
Yeah. Okay.
Like, in what situation would clusters like that be realistic?
Okay. First question. Okay, good. So think about the second. Yeah. So the question was, in what situation would these clusters be realistic? How can you give us an example of when that would occur? And I would once again draw out the location example. Yeah. So if you have a mobile social game or something, a location based social medium, a service like that, then and if you have a heuristic like something that is geographically close is also close with respect to your idea. If you have a notion like that, then it makes sense to do clustering on that R2, right? And an example where this would be the case, yeah? So assume you were after social search, yeah? And I mentioned that, so I'm a PhD student of mine is currently working on algorithms for social search, and the question whether social search does make sense at all, yeah? And the idea behind that is that what your friends know is maybe not as interesting in all the cases, but they have hidden knowledge that they might not reveal to the whole world, but might reveal to you, yeah? And the question is, what does that have to do with distance, yeah, geographical distance? And we made a study where we would try to compare the value of information measured with information retrieval-like techniques as a function of the geographical distance. And it's clearly visible that the relevance of information goes down with the geographical distance, right? That makes sense. If in China a bag of rice would fall down, you would not be interested in most cases. Yeah. So and naturally these things are intricate. Yeah. So the question is, what is an ideal cutoff? Yeah. Would you say you would include all the people in 100 kilometer distance in your search? Maybe, yeah. Maybe let's assume you're after things like this club recommender that I talked about, yeah. So combine social and distance, yeah. The question is, what are ideal boundaries? And this is very intricate, and there is a lot of real human behavior encoded in these things, yeah. Because you live, for example, in cities. Cities have characteristic extensions because of the way people would interact and all the supplies are brought in. And cities among cities have distances that are characteristic and so on. And neighborhoods and stuff, all these things are geographically distributed. Yeah? Good. Now, what I said is that if you want to use k-means, what you would have to know is the number of clusters in advance. Is there a way, like in modularity, to come up with such an estimate? And the answer is yes. You can use, once again, so you started with this objective function, yeah? And you can do several things. You could take the objective function and compute, let the algorithm run with several k's, and then choose the result that has the best value for JSQE. Yeah? So SQE stands for squared error. Yeah? But you can also use a different quality measure, like modularity-like functions or Dunn index and so on. And there's a whole bunch of these cluster quality measures out there. Yeah? And it may be a good idea to compute your cluster with one of these and to verify it in terms of the suitable number of clusters with another of these measures. Yeah. So you can bring in two modeling ideas at the same time. Yeah. And there's a lot of them around. I have a survey paper that's, I guess, 15 years old, and it lists, if I'm not completely mistaken, about 100 such measures. They're entropy based and there are lots of stuff. And a simple version is, for example, the Dunn index. Yeah. And what the Dunn index does is, to once again formalize the clustering paradigm, nothing else, but in that case takes care of several aspects. Yeah. So D1 is a distance function between two clusters. Yeah. So in essence, it takes care about the intra-cluster separation. And you can have lots of variants for this distance. For example, the single link distance function. Yeah. Which takes the minimum of any two locations. Yeah. So that's an optimistic measure. So if that's my cluster one and that's my cluster two, you would find the minimal distance. Yeah. But you could as well take here the maximum, which would be a more pessimistic way of modeling that. Yeah. And D2 is the diameter of the clusters. So what D2 does is to estimate the density in here once again. And the Dunn index takes the maximum distance within a cluster. And here we mean a metric distance, not a path distance, right? Okay. So, and then these are set into proportion, right? So what we have is that the distance between clusters should be, as large as possible, in a sense, while the diameter of the clusters should be as small as possible, yeah? And what we take is, pessimistically, take the minimum over all the clusters that we have. Yeah, and that's just one way to construct such a measure, and you can imagine there's lots of others. And each of them has its own strengths and weaknesses and its own fine-grained things that it models and that it does not model. Okay, good. Good. That is something we already talked about. Now, you can say, got the point. K-means is nice, easy to implement, converges fast, but has some difficulties. Aren't there other clustering algorithms? Some that are more local, in a sense. And yes, the answer is yes. And dbScan, for example, is an example for a clustering algorithm that a professor at LMU has devised. And he has come up with a whole family of such algorithms. And actually, for the problem of determining locations that I talked about, we used a variant of dbScan, not k-means. Okay? And the algorithm is rather simple. It has only two parameters. The minimum number of points that a point needs to have in its neighborhood to be a candidate for a cluster, and an epsilon that kind of determines the spatial metric extension of the cluster neighborhood that's in question. Yeah. And one interesting thing is that dbScan, besides being able to also solve problems like this for non-spherical clusters, and besides the fact that for dbScan we don't need to know K in advance, it's also nice because it has a notion of noise. Yeah, it has a notion of patterns that are not classified as being as assigned to a cluster at all. Yeah, and how does that work? Okay, so you would iterate over the following procedure. So you visit a previously unseen pattern, like this where the cursor is currently upon. And if in an epsilon neighborhood of that pattern, there are enough points, so at least min pt many, yeah, then I would start a new cluster. I would include the point and all of the points that are in that epsilon cluster in that new cluster, and repeat the algorithm for all of these. Okay, so I started from that, then I repeat it for that, and so on and so on. When I'm here, I would still include this C, but when I'm at C, I'm done, because in C's epsilon neighborhood, there are not enough points. Yeah. So, In a sense, it kind of proceeds locally, yeah? And it includes what it finds, what it deems dense enough, and then it stops. And for example, the blue N, if you consider that pattern at some point in the algorithm, you would not find any, because there are not enough points in there. So N is a noisy point that would not belong to a cluster. Okay? And since you can imagine that this procedure also works in curves, so to speak, we're not bound to just finding spherical clusters. This is simple, it's local, and it can deal with a lot of situations. Now, why is the world not confined to using dbScan-like algorithms? The answer is these also have their difficulties. One example why they're problematic or can be problematic is that not all regions in your pattern space need to have the same density. Okay? It may very well be the case that your pattern looks like that, your whole patterns. So while this is a cluster and this is a cluster, the densities are really different. Yeah? So you would need a different min PT and epsilon here, and a other larger or smaller larger epsilon and smaller min PT or so here. Yeah? And there are variants that have adaptive parameters, but we'll not discuss them. Okay? And the second thing is, it does not have an objective function that you optimize. So you don't have a clue of how good your clustering is. And so the models that use an objective function have the advantage that you can know the numerical value of that objective function at your solution, at your clustering. Good? Good. These I already said. Okay. Now, the question is, can we come up with something? Started from a different point. Okay. What we had was these algorithms, but these were all crisp clustering algorithms, meaning that a point is exactly member of exactly one cluster. Now, we can ask ourselves, is that realistic? Okay? In terms of social phenomena, yeah? And the answer is, there are many phenomena that you would want to make subject of your clustering that would cry for a fuzzy approach. Yeah? For example, formalizing interests. Yeah? Let's assume people state their interests as tags or short phrases. I like skiing, going out with my friend and drinking coffee, whatever. Short phrases, yeah? And if you want to do a clustering in terms of the interests for, let's say, recommender algorithms or social information retrieval, whatever, you would certainly want a fuzzy approach because some interests rather belong to a cluster, but not so much, and other interests might belong to a cluster to a very distinct degree, very high degree. So how do these fuzzy clustering approaches work? What can we do there? And surprisingly simple is if you gradually change the objective function of k-means, you would get a fuzzy variant, and that's called fuzzy c-means. Yeah? This is not so much in use today, but I want to explain the idea. Okay? Okay, so what we can certainly do is to formulate our original k-means objective function in that fashion, where instead of specifying over which patterns we would sum, yeah, namely those that belong to a certain cluster, what we can do is we can sum over all n and use... We can use a membership matrix, okay? So if you sum over all the n, yeah, you would use a membership matrix R and K, okay? So R and K is 1 if pattern n is in cluster K, and it's 0 otherwise, yeah? So that's a membership matrix R and K. And still, if you do the optimization and you have a non-overlapping constraint, you would get your well-known k-mean. means, but now formulated with this membership matrix. So these are the Barry centers just as before, but now it's formulated with the membership matrix. So this here is exactly same as this here. Yeah, exactly the same, but just reformulated with this RNK. Yeah, good. Now, how can we switch that objective function and get a fuzzy variant of that? And the answer is the only thing that you need to do is take the mth power of your RNK matrix elements. And m will be a measure of fuzziness. Yeah. So for m going to 1, you would get your original k-means back. Yeah, clearly. If you take m equal to 1, you have k-means. And if m goes to infinity, you would have a completely fuzzy clustering. What do I mean with that? So in a completely fuzzy clustering, you would say that any pattern n would belong to any cluster to a degree 1 over the number of clusters. Yeah. So that's a non-statement in a sense. Yeah. You have k clusters, but every pattern belongs to each one to the same degree. And so that's rather useless. So we'd have some fuzziness degree in between. That just makes sense. Okay. Now, we would optimize this generalized squared error function under constraints. Yeah. So for each pattern, these membership values, which will turn out to be not 0 or 1, as in the CRISP case, but in 0 or 1 as the interval. Yeah. So for fuzzy, we have R and K is in the interval 0, 1. Yeah. That these values must sum up to 1. Yeah. So the pattern belongs to each cluster to a certain degree, but the sum must be 1. And for each cluster, what we must have is that if we sum over the patterns, then we must get something that's larger than 0. If all the R and K are 0 for some cluster, then that cluster could be left out. It's just nothing, yeah? So this cluster is something that nobody belongs to any degree. If that's the case, we must throw it out. So that's the demand that we additionally have. And if you do the math, yeah, just take the gradient or the derivation with respect to these matrix elements and the cluster centers elements, what you find is that still the cluster centers are the Barry centers. So this formula is unaltered, except for this power here. But the membership matrix is that more or less complicated expression. Okay? Good. We will get to this expression in a second. Yeah? First of all, what we need to assume is that these cluster centers mu k should not coincide. Yeah? So for a distinct cluster, the cluster centers should be for two distinct clusters, the cluster centers should be different. If they're not different during the iteration, what you would do is you would start with a newly randomized membership matrix and then continue. Yeah? So re-randomized in a sense. Now, what about this term? And what about this this infinity and limit to 1 considerations here? Can we discover them back from this membership matrix? And the answer is yes, we can. Yeah. So in the limit m to infinity, what will happen? So if we let m go to infinity, this would go towards the exponent, would go to 0, and anything to the power 0 is 1. Yeah. So if we count from 1 to k all ones, we get large k. Yeah. And so r and k is 1 over k, and that's complete fuzziness. Okay. M going to infinity, complete fuzziness. Can we also recover our k-means? Answer is yes. If you look at the limit for m equal to 1, what would happen is that this exponent would go to infinity, right? Now, there are two cases. If you, for q to the power infinity, yeah? So, if q is smaller than 1, then q to the power infinity would be 1. And that's a very lax way of writing it. Please, for the mathematicians among you, this is the original sin, but you know what I mean, yeah? And if q is larger than 1, it would, q to the infinity would go to infinity, right? So if you keep on taking the roots, you would arrive at 1, yeah? So, this sum here, yeah, the original sum can be split for the case that k prime is equal to k, where we would get 1, and that's this one here, and the case where k prime is not equal to k, yeah? So, and for the mu k that has the smallest distance to a given pattern, yeah, we would have infinity for this sum, yeah. And if mu k is the actual prototype that has the minimum distance to that pattern, then we would get 0 for the sum. So in the first case, yeah, we would get 1 over infinity plus 1, which is 0. And in the second case, we would have 1 over 0 plus 1, and that's 1. Yeah, and that's precisely the k-means algorithm. Okay, back for the limit m equal to 1. Question? This one? Okay. Ah, yeah, sure. Yeah, sorry. Right, sorry, correct. Clear, yeah. No, that's okay. That one was the one that's okay. And that's also okay, isn't it? You're not sure? For the upper case? No. Ja, schon klar, mal kurz noch mit drüber nachgedacht. Kleiner. Ja, stimmt. Klar, logisch, Schwachsinn. Ja, you're right. All three of you. Cool. Good. But still, yeah, still it makes sense, because that's in essence what we have here as well. Yeah? So, thanks. You're right. Yeah. 0 and infinity, naturally. Cool. Yeah. Cool. So that's that. That's the algorithm. Okay. Now, this leaves us at a point where we would say, good. Okay. So what did you tell us? If I were to qualify these things, I would say this is old school data mining. Yeah. K-means, fuzzy C-means, and stuff like that. But what people would do these days is probabilistic machine learning. Yeah? Why do they do that? The answer is because probability theory is a framework which is able to naturally capture very many aspects of the models that we actually want. Yeah. So if you look at a modern machine learning book, like the book by David Barber, which is freely available for download, the book by David Bishop, which is a classic, easy to read and recommended, and last but not least, the book by Tom Murphy, which is a super brain. It contains everything at a very nice level, very elegant, but tough lecture, yeah? So whatever you want, all these books are probabilistic machine learning, yeah? And the question is, can't we come up with a fuzzy or fuzzy-like approach that actually works on a solid probabilistic basis that, in contrast to fuzzy C-means, does not naturally favor only spherical clusters, but can also deal with at least clusters that have an elongated elliptical shape? Yeah. And the answer is yes, there is something like that. And it's called a Gaussian mixture model. Okay. And today we will start with investigating Gaussian mixture models, and that's the last thing we will investigate in this data mining part. Yeah. And why did I choose to confront you with Gaussian mixture models? Okay. Answer. It is subject to the last assignment of the lab course for the games engineering students, so it's nice to know about Gaussian mixture models. Second, Gaussian mixture models are trained with the help of an algorithm that's called expectation maximization, and that's very prominent in machine learning. Yeah. Many people use that in one variant or the other. And that's nothing, in essence, but this alternating optimization technique that we learned when we talked about k-means clustering. Okay? And last but not least, mixture models have something that is also ubiquitously present in machine learning, and that's latent variables. Yeah. So what do I mean with that? We'll get to that in a second. Let's assume you have a collection of texts, okay? And you want to know the topics that occur in these texts. And what you do is, in a sense, these topics are latent quantities, yeah? So you know that they're somehow there, but they're not explicitly written on the documents, yeah? So if you have an article of Der Spiegel about the crisis in Ukraine, yeah? It clearly has a political topic. It's about Ukraine. It's about Russia. It's about the NATO and stuff like that. But besides of the heading, there is no true classification in terms of topics. Yeah. But topics are there. They are latent quantities. Yeah. You don't know them exactly, but you know that they are somehow there, or you assume that they're there. And you can turn that around by creating a generative process stating that if you were a machine that would be supposed to write an article for Der Spiegel, what you would need to do is you would need to pick a topic first, and that topic would have a characteristic probability distribution in terms of the vocabulary that it would use. Yeah. So if the topic is Ukraine crisis, it would not talk about schnitzel, for example. Presumably not. Yeah. So the probability of schnitzel for that topic is very low, approaching zero. Yeah. And then you would start to come up with selecting words at random, and then you have your pseudo article. Yeah. And that's a generative process which makes use of latent quantities. Yeah. And we will see that this is also the case for Gaussian mixture models, because the probability of some pattern, and that's where probability comes in, is a mixture of Gaussian functions. And this is indicated by this N for normal distribution. And this is a multivariate Gaussian, because the X are assumed to be vectors. So the centers of the Gaussians are also vectors, and the variances are covariance matrices, right? And these are the mixing weights. And we will see that these mixing weights would correspond to the probabilities of these latent quantities being in action. Yeah? So the generative process that you assume to be responsible for the patterns that you see is choose a Gaussian first, and here we'd have a drawing where X is two-dimensional, and the Gaussians are depicted with the help of their ISO lines. Yeah, choose a Gaussian first, and then compute the probability of that point from that Gaussian. Yeah, so since you have a prior probability for each Gaussian of pi k to choose it, in that way, the whole feature space can be generated. Okay. Now, if you turn that around, the generative process, and say, okay, good. What I actually have here is nothing but a set of points. Yeah. And I unfortunately don't know which component created which point. I assume that each point has been created by a distinct component, but I don't know. So these components, these latent quantities, are something that I assume to be there, but I don't know. Okay? So that's precisely the situation where you would know which Gaussian component created the points, and you'll see that we'd have a green Gaussian, a red Gaussian, and a blue Gaussian being responsible for creating it, and each point has a distinct color. It's either fully red, fully green, or fully blue, okay? Because we know which component created it. But that's the actual situation that you see. You don't know which Gaussian created a point. Yeah, and the only thing that you can come up with is a probability for each point having been created by a particular Gaussian. So these points here, these points that are almost all fully red, have a really high probability of having been created by this original red Gaussian. But the ones that are in between here, where I'm pointing my cursor, that they have a color that's between red and green, yeah, somehow in between, because we don't know which Gaussian created them. We have almost equal probabilities, yeah. So in essence, what we will find then is a responsibility for a given point of a given Gaussian having created that point, yeah. And by created, I mean, for example, sampled it in a sense. Yeah. So for the me, just three more minutes to stop here and then just tell you what I mean by Gaussian and what's the actual interpretation. Okay. So who knows, who does not know what a multivariate Gaussian function is? Who does know what a multivariate Gaussian function is? Okay, laughter. Okay, cool. So it appears as if this were not common knowledge. Okay, so let's explain that. So who knows what a normal distribution and a one-dimensional Gaussian function is? Hands up. Normal distribution. Who has never heard of a normal distribution? Okay, at least that is something. Yeah, cool. So, normal distribution, yeah? So if I have a one-dimensional X and I have a probability density function that is Gaussian, it looks like this, okay? Roughly, okay? That's something that is proportional to 1 over square root pi 2 pi x of 1 half x squared over sigma squared, if I'm not completely mistaken, yeah? And that's not true. You have to have x minus mu squared over sigma squared. And mu is just the center of that Gaussian, while sigma is a measure of how broad the Gaussian is, yeah? And that's the normal distribution that you know, presumably know from school. Yeah. So it's an approximation of for example, the binomial distribution, and it's absolutely central for probability theory. Yeah. And if you're interested in the probability of this underlying probability random variable, let's say being smaller than B, yeah, what you would have, let's say here is B, yeah, what you would have to do is to integrate this thing and determine the whole surface, oops, under that curve, and that's just the probability. So that would be integral from minus infinity to B of that normal function here, which is parameterized by mu and sigma, yeah, often you write sigma squared, yeah. And that's a function of x, yeah, as we have it here, okay? And that's the probability, okay? So that's what we have for the one-dimensional case. If you go from the one-dimensional case, just give me 30 seconds and I'll be done. If you go from the one-dimensional case to the n-dimensional case, things are just the same, but only with higher number of dimensions. Okay. Let's assume we're talking about two dimensions. Yeah. So still we have a value for the probability density, but now we are having an R2 here. Yeah. And now this bell curve becomes something like a hat. Yeah. So this is still a bell-shaped curve, but it is like a hat. Yeah. So drawn like this. And it still has a center, right? So that's, but the center now is a vector. Yeah. A two-dimensional vector. It also has a notion of width, but now it has to have a specification of width in two directions. And if you look at this from above, yeah, so this is x1 and this is x2, and you draw that from above, you would, for example, here see that the Gaussian could have lines of equal functional value that look like this. Yeah, so it's more elongated in that direction than in that. But you can also have spherical Gaussians or very elongated Gaussians, and that kind of takes over to infinite or very high number of dimensions. And that's the form it has, yeah? So still x minus mu, yeah? But now this sigma squared down here becomes the inverse of something that we will call a covariance matrix. And that's just the matrix that determines these extensions here in these directions in our feature spaces. And this is the square, yeah? So x minus mu is a vector. This is a matrix, and you'd have a scalar product instead of just a normal power 2, yeah? And that's the whole point, yeah? And that's all we're going to deal with. The question would now only be, how do we use that for clustering, and how do we train such a model? And please, there's some math in there, but it's a math that's not useless, yeah? So if you understand that, you would probably have understood most of machine learning, or at least a significant part, yeah, of the original idea of how machine learning works. So next lecture, I will go into more depth on these Gaussian mixture models. And don't be afraid of the math. Just try to follow these argumentations. And one more time, if you want me to give a probability theory introduction, please tell Vanessa, and she will then tell me if I should do that. So see you games tomorrow and social computing next week.